Welcome to Real Talk, Real Estate Discussions with Andrew Kirsch. In each episode, Andrew interviews industry leaders. We'll hear their real-time opinions on today's market, their background and unique career highlights, and guidance for newcomers into the industry. You can find this show at scholarkirsch.com and on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. Now here's the host of Real Talk, Andrew Kirsch.
Episode 25. On today's episode, I have Paul Schoen and Artem Teppler of Schoen Teppler, two really interesting guys. Paul immigrated from Mexico. Artem immigrated from Russia. They came to this country, you know, not knowing a lot of people, started in the real estate industry during the recession of 08, 09, bought and flipped homes, made some money, turned that into a small development company for apartment buildings, starting with 15 units, then got to 60 units. And now today they're building a 400-unit apartment building in Austin. And I just thought their story was really fascinating, very gutsy guys. All their loans are signed by them personally, full recourse loans. And it's just a testament to them and how they've built themselves up, frankly, without a lot of help. They didn't come from a lot and just hard work and guts. They've gotten to be a prolific developer in Southern California and in Texas. I hope you enjoy my conversation with them. Hello, welcome to another edition of Real Talk. I'm here with my friends Paul Schoen and Artem Teppler of a very creative real estate developer name, Schoen Teppler. How'd you get that name?
Paul, you want to go with this story or should I?
Why is Paul first? I mean, people ask me, why is Jeff Sklar first? Sklar, and that's because he's 6'5" and I'm not. So
it's a great story. It's a really good story. So he's also from Mexico. I'm from Russia. We were originally called Rumex, Russia first, Mexico second, Rumex Group. And we were flipping homes and branding ourselves as another project by Rumex Development Group. And then Remax sent us a cease and desist letter saying you are infringing on our name. And we were so angry. And I was like, we're going to fight these guys. This is our name. And then our lawyer at the time suggested, don't bother. So then we're like, what are we going to name ourselves? And then we just didn't want to spend more time. And then we flipped the coin on whose name was going to go first. And it's Schoen Teppler. And I'm actually glad it's Schoen Teppler because it sounds better, Schoen Teppler than Teppler Schoen. I think having the one syllable in the two just flows better.
Yeah. You know what? That's amazing. And so how many times do you tell that story?
No one really asked too much about our name because it's so boring. But I posted the Remax letter. We sound like a Jewish law firm, but I posted the Remax letter on Twitter and people are like, you should have fought that. And I was like, we were just trying to make money. We weren't like branding ourselves. So,
well, you could go Schoen Teppler and then in parentheses, formerly known as Rumax. What was it? Rumax.
R-U-M-E-X. It feels like Remax just cornered the RMX market. So
that sounds. Yeah, you know what? I say go after them. I agree, but use your money, not mine. All right. So for our audience that may not know you guys, why don't you describe what Schoen Teppler does?
Go ahead.
So we're a vertically integrated real estate development company here in Los Angeles. So we built around $250 million worth of apartments, and then we have around $150 million in the pipeline. But a couple of years ago, we found a good niche building boutique middle market apartments here in LA. But a couple of years ago, we started exploring in other markets because it's just getting tougher and tougher to build in Los Angeles. So we picked Texas. So we're now also looking to build in Austin, Dallas, San Antonio.
Got it. And then when did you guys start?
Started in 2009, we started flipping homes. And then in 2012, we built our first apartment building.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'd love to hear the story of, you know, how you guys went from homes to smaller apartments to now larger apartments. But, you know, the discussion that everyone is talking about is really just today's market and how quickly it changed from, I would say, first quarter of 22 to, you know, when, not that we're going to get back to a 2021 first quarter 22 market, because I think that was probably artificially unhealthy, both from a human capital standpoint and just from a pricing standpoint, so much of it didn't make sense. But what are you looking at right now? How do you perceive the market? I guess it's a loaded question, and there's so many different avenues we could take, but just sort of what is your take on today's market?
I'm bullish. If we can build in Los Angeles, we're in such a housing crisis. So it's hard to build, but if you can get it done and build it, the demand is there. So they'll rent, you'll get good, you'll get operating income. The question is where the rates are. It's tough to make a good spread on that. But I'm a believer, if the demand's there, build it and you'll be fine if you can build it.
Yeah, I'm with Paul. I think LA is still in a housing crisis. Fundamentals didn't really change. Everyone's talking about the demographic, California is losing people, but a lot of it is not coming from city of LA, and a lot of it's more lower income people that are leaving. We built towards the higher end to qualify for one of our one bedrooms. You have to make $70,000. So we believe still there's a lot of demand. The issue is the costs have gone up so much. And what a lot of people don't know in this market, and we kind of learned, is that when you're building one bedrooms and you're building studios and you're building twos, the price per unit to build is not that much different, but you get so much more rent for a two bedroom than a one. So ones, we build close to, I think, about 400 or 500 one bedrooms, and they're all townhome style. We built them for 350 to 370 a piece, and they're worth about 500,000. Today, the same unit would cost us 470 to build, and it's still worth 500,000 if you're using the metrics before the rates went up. Right now, no one knows what anything's worth. The only trades that are happening are kind of stress trades that people need to sell. So, you know, we could all argue about what the cap rates are. Did they go up? Did they not? Most likely, if you sell today, the cap rates are up. We used to underwrite a 4.25 kind of exit. Right now, if we were underwriting, we'd probably underwrite 4.75. And in LA, we look at it as people look at a yield on cost. We look at it, can we create a margin, a spread between what we're all into it for and what it's worth? And if we used to be able to create a 30, 40% margin, now it's maybe 20% margin, 25. And we know now that we can't build one bedroom units because the two bedrooms really cost me the wooden box, maybe $5,000-$10,000 more per unit. Just we used to build one bedroom, 1.5 bathroom units. So these are two twos, just a little bit of more drywall, framing, flooring, the rest is the same. And then you get $1,000 more a month for that unit. So that was kind of pencil. We have two bedroom projects that are going on, three bedroom project with slab on grade kind of work. But the one bedroom is that all these guys entitled, and we bid out right now. We have a project where a partner brought it to us. It was going to be a joint venture. The land was bought somewhat correctly. It wasn't maybe paid a little bit more than we would have, but the deal is you're all into 440 on a unit that's worth 440. So there's no margin being created building that. So that's kind of done. But there are parts of LA, West LA, especially Santa Monica, where the numbers still work, where you can build bigger units. And I think you have to really be like us, granular into the construction numbers to really understand where the costs went up and what works and what doesn't. A lot of people use price per square foot, which is kind of a wrong measurement. I wrote a Substack post on it. People are like, what do you build on a price per square foot? Well, it depends. Well, how big is the unit? Is it a micro unit? Is it a large unit? And it's more of a per unit number that kind of matters. So answer to your story, LA, we believe in it long-term. Other markets, we still believe in multifamily long-term. We have a 400 unit we're entitling in Austin. But the problem is the equity, you know, they would have been fine funding to something that's also like, you know, 5-8 yield on cost. Now they're looking for something that's like 6.25, 6.5 yield on cost, but nothing changed in the market. The rents softened a little bit. Maybe the cost came down a little bit. but the fundamentals really haven't changed other than the expectations. So that's why it's getting a little bit harder to finance, but maybe that slowdown is good. They have a lot of units that are being delivered in Austin. They'll get absorbed and then people will kind of get going again. And then the rest of the country will not experts are.
Yeah, well, okay, there's a lot to unpack there, Artem, and I appreciate the detailed answer because you're right. It's everything. Look, when I give a legal answer, right, it depends. It's so factual specific. And same thing with you guys from a construction cost standpoint. It's very factual specific. But I thought I heard you say that if it is going to cost for a two-bedroom, what, somewhere in the $375,000 a unit, and you're going to sell that for what, in the low to mid fours, is that enough of a spread with interest rates going up? Maybe they're stabilizing, but they certainly have gone up a lot more than a year ago. So how can anything pencil?
The numbers are a little off. So we used to be all in at 370 per unit and they were worth about 500. So we used to create 140 of equity kind of spread per deal. Now the same units, probably 450 are all into it for a one bedroom. And it depends on the type of one bedroom. We did townhomes. Those are probably still worth 500, if that. And there isn't really spread. And the ULA tax is kind of throwing a wrench into the whole thing when you have to underwrite it. So it's hard. It's harder to make things work. LA is one of those markets where we believe if ULA tax stays in place here, the existing real estate values will just keep going up and up and up. So we're going to have more than a traditional 3.7% rent growth because none of the institutions are going to build here. So it's just going to be small family offices that are building and holding stuff that are going to be building here. So that kind of makes sense with a build and hold investor for LA, but it's hard to make. We used to do a lot of merchant building with investors that wanted kind of to build and sell. That's hard to make work today.
Yeah, it's so funny just to touch upon ULA, and I've spoken about it on prior podcasts. So I don't want to delve and go back onto my soapbox, but what you just said, it's completely counterintuitive of what the government and the people behind ULA were trying to achieve. They were trying to get money to combat the homeless problem. But if ULA is going to cause major developers and major capital to leave LA, then we're going to not be able to solve this, the undersupply issue. We're not going to be able to build our way out of the homeless issue.
Yeah. I heard one analogy that I loved saying, it's like we're farmers and we farm food, but now they're taxing the farmers. So there's going to be less food available. It's like they're just creating more of a famine.
Yeah, agreed. So how do you compare the metrics that you just articulated, Artem, versus the real estate owner operators that are in the value add space? Do you still think it makes sense to build versus buying existing, say an 80s or a 90s or even an earlier 60s or 70s product, improving it, holding it for 3 to 5 years and selling?
Well, we just did a value add deal in LA. Paul could talk speak about that. He wanted to get into value add. And during COVID, I wanted to do ground up in Texas and Paul wanted to do value add. So he just did a 28 unit building value add in LA. He could talk about that experience.
Yeah, it actually went well. We turned around 75% of the building, but it's hard. It's hard in Los Angeles. It's impossible to predict how much value add can you do because of all the rent control measures. So in LA, it's just, I think if you buy, you're buying way below replacement cost. So logically, it makes sense to be buying those. Just you don't know the time horizon on when you're going to be able to be turning those units and increasing those rents. So it's hard. It's harder to come up with a model on doing value add in Los Angeles. Other markets.
But you need patient equity to do that in LA.
Yeah. And you need patient equity to now build in LA because of the ULA tax and because costs are so high. So I think in Los Angeles, you just need patient equity to do value add or ground up. In other markets, yeah, if you can buy value add where you're going to spend $20,000-$30,000 per unit and make it class B apartment and it's significantly below of new construction, then I think it makes sense to do value add. So I think it just, but can you find those deals?
So what do you put in your model as the limit that you can pay for land, I guess, on a per unit basis, or how do you look at it?
It depends on the area, but it's like we used to build a lot in Echo Park and Koreatown and Hollywood, and we used to pay between 30 and 100 per door. Just are we building micro units or are we building 2 and 3 bedrooms? And now in some of these deals that we're looking at, we're underwriting, it's like even if they gave us a lane for free, where costs are at now and where rates are at, it just doesn't make sense.
So what can those people do?
Not sell, just keep it as a house or a duplex or a fourplex.
And just wait.
And just wait, yeah.
And so where have you seen construction costs go over the last 30, 60, 90 days? Is it coming down or still going up?
Oh, I could speak about that all day long. So I did out all our projects, and this is what I do. I mean, when we started, to give you an idea, plumbing was like 11,000 per unit. Now it's like 22,000 per unit. Electrical pre-COVID was 8,700 per unit we used to pay. And now we're paying, I think it's like 17,000 per unit.
Local. So it sounds like, just to cut you off real quick, Artem, sounds like it's doubled, but have rents doubled? Or
no, rents definitely did not double. In LA, they didn't even go up. And it's only certain trades that doubled. Lumber shot up, now it's back down to probably pre-COVID levels, somewhat normal. But other trades have not come down. So, you know, electrical's still high. Drywall's a little bit up. Appliances are up. Everything's up. So if I had to guess, it's probably costs have gone up about 30% since pre-COVID. But the rents didn't go up at all in LA. Like, we're basically maybe a little bit above pre-COVID level. But, you know, when you take the cap rate kind of adjustment on that and the ULA tax, it's kind of cuts into the margins quite a bit.
So why continue to build in LA? I know you said because we're supply constrained. And although the narrative is that a lot of people, I forget how many people have left California in general. I know you said you're building in Austin. But what about markets where rents have shot through the moon, and I would assume the construction costs have gone up commensurate, maybe even less than what they've gone up in LA?
I think we're seeing it everywhere, like from talking to people where construction costs are hard to make work to get to above a 6 yield on cost in a lot of different places. We looked at Arizona, and Arizona surprisingly almost had the same construction costs as LA when we went out to a project. We had 10 acres in escrow. We just assigned over to kind of a long-term builder over there. And the cost, we looked at it, was surprisingly way higher than Texas. I couldn't figure out why. It was more almost like California pricing on costs. And we don't know where those markets are. I think development's very local. We believe in LA long-term. We believe that on average, there's been 40, 50,000 people that have moved to city of LA per year. And we're not adding anywhere near enough housing to support all that. So historically, we think the rents are going to keep going up and up here. And we feel the safest kind of doing long-term builds if it holds in LA, but it's very hard to scale and do big projects in LA. You know, I spoke to a developer yesterday. They're about to break ground next year. They bought land in 2006 in Silver Lake, you know, and there's a project in Sherman Oaks that a group just broke ground this year. They started in Pinewoods in 2004. We don't want to wait 20 years to get a project permit ready to get it out of the ground. That's why we're looking at Texas, where you could get a project ready in a year, 2 years, and get it out of the ground and get long escrows to prepare it and kind of get it ready for equity and kind of do a lot more projects and get them out of the ground. And that's our basically thesis, is for the next decade, we're going to go to do institutional deals in states where it's easier to do institutional deals and become local to those states. Neither Paul or I are actually, you know, the equity said, well, you guys aren't from Texas. How are you going to do it here? Well, I'm not from LA, and we figured out how to do 30 buildings here. And Paul's not from LA either. So we both moved here. I moved here in 2009. Paul, when did you move here? 08?
Yeah.
Yeah, we both moved here. We figured out the market. You kind of looked at every closed comp. You look at every closed sale, and you figure it out. It's not rocket science. So we're not going to be pioneering in new areas. We're going to look for comps around us to make sure they're supporting rent comps and everything else. And we're going to use all local consultants in Texas, and we're just going to focus on those markets to do bigger projects. But we are going to keep going. We do believe in LA long term, and maybe it's a mistake. I don't know. We've seen a lot of, you know, guys, you know, that have left this market and have done way better doing in other markets. So maybe it's just a mistake that we're still doing by sticking to LA.
Yeah, I would say 90% of my client base lives in LA, but 2/3 of our transactions are outside of California. However, most of those are value add transactions. I think it's very challenging to develop ground up in a different state, unless if you're just going to be on a plane or have boots on the ground and have a whole team that you've worked with. Value add is different than being a developer, as you guys know. I want to circle back on a couple of things you said, Artem, and I open up to both you and Paul on timing from the time you start a project or interested in a particular project, working with the government and getting a permit to, I guess, a grading permit to go subterranean or a building permit. How long is that taking now? If you were to start inquiring about a project today.
Well, I'll share this. It used to take like 7 to 9 months, and then COVID happened and there were some more delays. So now it was, and by the way, we stay under 50 unit base units. So they're mostly buy right or TOC projects. So now they're taking a year to 15 months. We're trying to close down the timelines to get it back to under a year. But I would say it's not that bad if you stick to buy right TOC projects, or we're not doing any heavy entitlements.
Yeah. And then are there any affordable requirements?
Yeah, we usually use the affordable requirements. Usually around 10% is the number that makes sense. 10% of units become affordable. Anything above that, if you're going above 15%, any deal that I look at that has more than 15% low-income units, we just pass on it. Just the mathematics don't make sense.
Mm-hmm. Even if you get density bonus?
Yeah. Yeah, all I'm looking at density. Yeah, we've used state bonus density, SB 1818, on most of our projects, and they had 10% of base units as affordable, and then TOC, they're usually 10% of total units as kind of affordable, and SB 1818 used to take 8 to 9 months for us to basically get permit ready, and TOC probably a year and a half. During COVID, those numbers expanded, and like Paul said, we're hoping they're contracting, but it's still kind of not going as fast as it was pre-COVID.
Now, have you guys looked into any builder's remedy projects? And our audience may not know what that is, but, you know, the state basically mandated, you know, certain amount of housing be built, and cities such as Santa Monica and other cities that are opposing growth were not meeting the numbers that the state was requiring, and therefore developers were coming in and either filing lawsuits or mandating that their projects be approved. Have you been following that or trying to get in on that?
We followed it a bit, but we weren't playing on. We mostly build in the city of LA. Like you said, development, you have to really understand the city, you have to understand the zoning. So we focus on city of LA, and now we're focusing on NDOT. We're adding one city at a time. We're focusing on Austin. But where timelines did increase a lot for us is during building. So permitting phase, we got to figure it out. We got the right consultants. We've done 30 buildings in LA. We know how to get them RTI. Where there has been a lot of delays is in building. Our first building in 2012 that we built with no experience took us 13 months to build. Now,
how many units was that?
That was a 13 unit.
Oh, okay.
But now we just completed a 16 unit. So similar size. And now they're taking close to 2 years, some even more than 2 years. So it's the city, it's Department of Water and Power, it's the subcontractors. It just, that's where we're seeing a lot more delays. That
a lot of inspectors, inspection, you have to wait a week for kind of inspection. And going back,
before you can move.
Yeah, and going back to the builder's remedy thing, we never quite looked at it. We always wanted to do everything by right. where there's a certainty of close for our investors. And with Builders Remedy, a lot of these guys are going in, but there's no, they don't know how long they're going to get litigated for. And some cities are litigating, they're not accepting. And I think there's one in Redondo Beach that's kind of going on like that. And we just, for us, it's not something we want to do. We'd rather go and look outside of state where people actually want you to build, as opposed to fight the governments to try to get anything across. Maybe if we're a little bit older, more wealthier and more patient, maybe we'd be willing to take on those battles, but we're not quite there yet.
Yeah, well, Artem, maybe when you get some gray hair, then you'll start doing that. Well, so those that are listening to our podcast won't be able to see that joke or appreciate it. So apologize.
I have no hair, but I used to have hair before I started construction 10 years ago.
I thought you were going to say used to have hair before you worked with Paul.
That was before I worked with Paul. When he was dealing, when we were flipping houses, he speaks Spanish. He dealt with construction. And the way we got into construction, we kept getting screwed over by contractors. And I was like, I could figure this out. So I took a GC exam, and then I've been stuck in construction for a decade ever since.
See what happens when you try and be proactive and help the company.
And he's got perfect hair.
Yeah. Although something happened to the sides of his hair. I don't. Where is that hair? All right. Let's go from hair to actual to capital markets. I'm curious, how do you guys finance your deals, both from the debt perspective and also equity? And when are you closing on your land? Are you getting long-term escrows so that you don't have to come up with the money to buy the land until you're shovel ready? Or just walk through that process for the audience.
Yeah, in Los Angeles, it was impossible to get long escrow. So we had to, we were lucky, we would argue to get a 30-day escrow. So we would call our surveyor and our soils engineer. It's like, we need rushed. We only have a couple weeks of DD. Let's get this done. And then we, in 30 days, we have to buy the land. These are for our middle market boutique apartment developments. So we would buy the land. Usually we work with a few high net worth families, family offices to finance the equity. Buy the land with the equity, get it permit ready with equity. And then once we're permit ready, we go out to mostly local, regional, community banks for the construction debt. And then once we're permit ready, we get the construction loan and we start building.
And would you need to then raise more equity in order to build, or the equity that you raised in order to take down the land was sufficient?
Yeah, we would usually just calculate an approximate right from the beginning, take it down the land, would raise the entire equity amount. And then once we got to construction loan, if it changed a little higher or lower, we would raise a little more equity or a little less. And then we'd get the construction loan and go from there. Once built, we would lease up the building as fast as we could. Sometimes we would get a bridge loan for the lease up, but usually we would just lease up the building as fast as we can and then go out to either agency or Chase Bank and refinance out of the construction loan.
And all our construction loans are personally guaranteed. I hear there's such things as not personally guaranteed loans, but Paul was getting all personally guaranteed loans for us. So we guaranteed over $100 million of personal guarantees. And I'm hoping to one day get a non-personal guarantee loan.
Wow. Let's talk about that. So there is something called non-recourse, but there is a completion guarantee. But so you're saying your construction loans are all full recourse, full repayment in addition to the completion guarantee?
Yeah.
So
community banks, when they're lending you $3 to $5 million, they want you on the hook. If it's like a $30 million loan, you could probably get a completion guarantee. When you're borrowing $3 million, they basically want it all. So I joke around about Paul, but that's all available for these middle market kind of deals. So me and Paul have personally it's like our claim to fame. Everyone's like, don't ever personally guarantee a loan. And we're like, yeah, we've personally guaranteed over $100 million, like 30 loans of construction loans. So that's kind of how we did it.
Well, now I know why you don't have any more hair, Artem, because of your full recourse exposure. Well, I mean, look, it takes balls, right? And in order to get these deals done, you believed in yourself, and the proof is in the pudding. But I guess let me ask a personal question. You don't have to reveal your personal financials, but how, I mean, you guys were starting out. You did, you went from flipping houses to doing small apartment buildings to mid-sized apartment buildings. And now I know, because of other conversations, you're planning on doing a you know, close to a four, maybe a 400 unit building in Austin. You guys have always been able to be the guarantors. I know many clients of mine are not in a position where the bank will take the guarantee from the developers, and they need to bring other partners that have a larger balance sheet. So has that ever been an issue for you, that the bank is not satisfied with just Artem and Paul?
Definitely at the beginning. I think we called over 30 banks and no one wanted to give us a loan because we had no experience. We didn't have a big balance sheet. But once we finally got a bank to believe in us, and once we started getting, we started completing buildings, then it got easy. So then
our net worth grew, and we always borrowed. Basically what the banks look for is your net worth combined being equivalent to the loan, and the liquidity equals to 10% of that. And sure, all of them were willing to share our liquidity. So as our net worth kind of grew, we just borrowed a bunch of little loans from a lot of little banks where we were, no one would give us $30 million at a time, but they 10 banks would give us $3 million at a time. So that's kind of how we did it. And that's why we never went bigger. And then we didn't know about this whole co-GP world that existed, that people could provide credit enhancement. We didn't know that word. We were like, how do we do bigger deals? We're like, well, we can't. So we're just going to do a bunch of little ones. So
yeah, well, before I get into the co-GP world, my first thought when you were talking about relying on the community banks, the discussion over the last 30, 60 days since Silicon Valley Bank, First Republic Bank, Signature Bank, PacWest just sold half of their loan portfolio or more than half to Kennedy Wilson. There's a lot of concern about the health of community banks. If they're not around, I mean, how do you guys replicate your process?
Yeah, that's a concern because we work a lot with those banks. We work with First Republic, we work with PacWest. First Foundation doesn't have a multifamily program anymore. So I'm still talking to a lot of these lenders that we work with, like Cathay Bank. We work with a lot of them. They're still lending. East West Bank is still lending. Nano Bank. So there's still lenders out there that are lending. It's more expensive, but there's the market's still there.
And then hopefully it will grow up and into the big banks and do bigger deals too with co-GPs. That's what we're trying to grow up and not have any recourse.
See, we're doing this podcast, Paul. It's more of an intervention. And so this is the whole reason for it. Paul, no more recourse, okay? No, it's so you talk about co-GP, and you know, the people have always said it takes, and I say it on the legal side, right? At least if we're talking about legal fees, it's the same amount of work to do a $10 million deal as it is to do a $100 million deal. The documentation's the same, the process is the same. It's just there's one more zero, and therefore there's the percentage of legal fees as to the project cost is a lot lower. And if it's a $10 million deal, it just, my fees seem astronomical, right?
Yeah.
In terms of the types of deals that you're doing, I would assume it takes the same amount of work to do a $10 million deal as it is a $100 million deal. And so talk about the thought process of how do you move to a larger deal? Do you even want to do larger deals? Is it worth it? And how are you pivoting yourself to do it, assuming that you want to do those larger deals?
Go for it, Artur.
I think I really confused you.
No, you didn't confuse me. I was just trying to be polite because I feel like I've been hogging the conversation. But I completely agree with you. It takes the same amount of work. Now, from a GC perspective, it takes me the same exact amount of work to do a 14-unit building, a 28-unit building, same amount of subcontractors I have to deal with, as a 43-unit building. Now, the bigger deals are probably even easier because you could have the same thing. If you're paying a superintendent $100,000 a year, you could pay a better superintendent $150,000 a year on a bigger deal, and you're dealing with more quality kind of people. So it's easier to do bigger deals and kind of scale. Now, for us, the limiting factor was signing on the construction debt and the equity. Now that we figured out the co-GP world, and we're doing a 400-unit building, and when you're paying, let's say, $500,000 to an architect, it's the level of service and professionalism is way higher than when you are dealing with smaller. You have a whole team that's kind of responsible. They give you reports, and they go in. So I would argue that it's actually way easier to do bigger deals. But for us to do more of them, we're going to be going the next level with the co-GP route, because that GP investment is, we need that. And, you know, I think the beauty of doing bigger deals is you have bigger fees and you could hire bigger staff and quality people and quality kind of development managers or associates and MBAs to kind of help scale the business. And that's what we've realized. And that's where we're trying to go in the next two decades, is to do more institutional deals, bigger fees, bigger deals, more help. And I think they're actually easier to do, I'll be honest with you. Because on our level, there really is no, there's not that much talent in the middle market space for construction. Because like you said, if someone figures out construction, why would they build a 12, 14, 30 unit building when they could do an 100 unit building? So cream kind of eventually rises to the top. So you're always stuck in that level where you kind of have to almost do it yourself. And that's why we're looking to do, go up and to go bigger levels. And that's something it took us a while to figure out. We've heard people talk about it, and we just couldn't figure out how to do the big deals. And that'll actually Substack on that.
Also, in Los Angeles, it's hard to do big deals because then you're entitling for 10 years and you don't know when you're going to get your permit. So we had a good formula. I think we do have a good formula at building these smaller boutique apartment buildings. At the beginning, we were refinancing all of our capital out, doing it again, refinancing the equity out, doing it again. And it's hard to add supply here. So we just felt safe doing what we're doing here.
Have you when do you decide to sell?
When the investors want us to. We never want to.
Yeah.
Yeah, but if you're set up as a syndication, then you guys control when to sell.
Yeah, our syndications we really haven't sold. It's more when we partner with a family office.
Sure.
Yeah, understood. All right, so let's finish up about, you know, more of this structured equity that you're trying to get into, and it's where I spend most of my legal hours of advising clients on co-GP and LPs, and from, you know, institutional private equity to boutique private equity. So how have those conversations gone? What types of economics, you know, you don't have to name names, but sort of generally, are you seeing the co-GP providers expect in terms of the percentage of capital they're able or willing to provide, and the promote that they want for it? And are they wanting fees as well? And are they willing to sign on guarantees? So walk our audience through that whole co-GP world.
Yeah,
we've seen it all over the place, from like they want 50-50 on the capital commitments all the way to 90-10. So they provide 90%, we provide 10% of the capital committed. And then from, they'll provide credit enhancements. If they do, they want to participate on the fees, on the developer fees. So I think where Artem and I discuss and we feel comfortable is 80-20. So they provide 80%, we provide 20%. We keep the fees, and then they participate on the promote 50-50, and they provide a credit enhancement.
So there, you're seeing the market of co-GP requiring 50% of your promote for providing 80% of your co-invest capital.
And the credit enhanced, yeah.
And seen it go from 50 to 90. 50 to 90 for 50% of the promote. And then The way I look at it is the fee should go to where, who does the work? So if the development company does the work, the developer fee should go towards the development company. If they're getting involved and they're another developer, then those fees kind of be split, whatnot. But I think me and Paul, I think the fairest one we heard was basically 80-20, contribution, and 50-50 on the split, 100% of the fees kind of are, let's say, kept by the person that's kind of doing the work, and the cost overruns and the risk is shared basically pari passu.
Yeah. You know, several of my clients on the co-GP side, and it's all, you know, there's so many deals, so I'm not saying anything that's out of turn here. Their rule of thumb is 2-to-1. So if they're providing, let's say, 90% of the co-GP, they're going to want 45% of the promote. If they provide 80% of the co-GP, they'll take 40% of the promote. So it's basically 50% of what they're providing is what they'll take and promote. But then the next layer is the institutional JV of your LP partner. And are co-GPs telling you or offering to you the relationships that they have with these institutional LP partners, or are you then having to go get LP capital?
We're still in the beginning stages of that, but we're looking at that, and they come with both. But go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I think it's a combination of both. They have the relationships, they'll bring the relationships. If they don't have the relationships, we do it together. We go out and raise LP capital together.
Sure. Well, you'll find the differences between a syndication. I mean, you've done joint ventures, right? You've done them on your smaller deals. And I tell clients that there's not a right or wrong way to do it. The syndication way may be more headaches because you're dealing with many investors, but you are controlling all the decisions versus a joint venture model where it's one-stop shopping. It's one provider of capital, but they're going to tell you when you have to sell, when the refinancing, when you're allowed to go to the bathroom, if Paul can have a haircut like that. And that's you're working for someone.
Yeah. Yeah. And with the family office, that's basically what we've been doing. It's like,
in our family offices deals, they basically have all major decisions. So we're practically there. We feel like only in our syndicated deals do we have a say. In the family offices, they have all major decisions, and we're okay with that.
Yeah. All right, you guys ready for the world famous Real Talk lightning round set of questions?
Let's go for it.
I mean, Artem, you look like you're nervous. You're a big guy, Russian.
I don't know what I'm getting myself into over here.
Well, you know, you got yourself into getting a GC contractor's license, and now that's all you're doing. That this will have, I promise, it won't have long lasting ramifications more than the next 2 minutes.
All right, let's do it.
Volumes, right? I don't even have a list of questions. They just pop up into my head because there's nothing else that's filling that space. All right. I know before we were talking about jiu-jitsu, and you guys are, when I see you, you're extremely fit, strong guys. When you fight each other, who wins?
Paul, 99.9% of the time. I think there might have been one time I got him. And I think he just wasn't expecting it. So Paul's a division one athlete.
But Artem, this isn't like playing tennis or golf or pickleball where, you know, you have a friendly competition with your partner. You guys are beating the shit out of each other.
I'm trying to choke him unconscious, and usually it's the other way that happens.
So, and after it's all done, you guys are all good and have a beer and talk shop? I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah. So this is what happened. Artem yells at me all the time while at work, and because I bring recourse loans. And then we go to jiu-jitsu and we beat each other up, and then afterwards we're great.
That's the key. I raised my voice at him, and he takes it out on me on the mat.
Just as long as you don't bring me, I'm an athlete, and I've played baseball and even football and tennis and golf, and I just don't bring your lawyer into a jiu-jitsu match because I will get my ass kicked. I mean, how much do you guys weigh each?
I'm about 200 pounds, and Paul's, what are you, 180?
180.
But you wrestled, right, Paul, in high school or college?
Yeah, high school and college.
And so you were talking about the lawyer. You were talking about bringing a lawyer, and I want to say he brought one of our investors in to a boxing sparring match and broke his rib. And my God, there were guys like, go light with me. And Paul broke his rib just going light with him. So,
oh my God. If anyone is watching, I'm like turning red because I'm nervous about being invited.
Paul's like, hey, come. It'll be fun. It'll be a good time. He's like, it's the next golf, he tells people. And they go home with broken ribs.
Yeah, I don't think you can break your ribs in golf unless if somehow you get hit with a golf club, I guess. But that's crazy. All right. I don't even know where to go from there. But how did you guys decide to go from flipping houses to building apartments?
Artem was a genius and drove by a building and saw just a brand new, I think it was a 12-unit Artem in the West Side.
Yeah, so I mean, I went to school for real estate development. I'll tell you, it started a little earlier. So I was flipping homes and I was driving around New Jersey and I saw this big building going up and I was making like $30,000 per flipping home. And I realized, I was like, wow, I was like, if this guy's making $30,000 per apartment that he's building here, he just has to stay in one place. This is better. So then I figured out what real estate development was. I went to school for real estate development. I thought it was going to be a trade school at NYU. It was not completely a trade school. Moved out here. We started flipping houses. And then I saw one guy just, we were building some duplexes. I saw one guy build a 10,000 square foot box and the costs were like 160 a foot. He bought the land for 500,000 in West LA. It was 160 a foot, 10,000 square foot box. And he sold it for $3.5 million. And I go, Paul, did this guy just make $1 million? So we literally took that guy's whole team. We took his architect, we took his engineer, we took his design. And then we basically ran with that for about a decade, except for we replaced, the architect, and we improved on the design a little bit.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And we just had to learn construction in the middle of it.
Yeah, and you know, I got to give you guys credit, a lot of credit, because I remember meeting you or seeing you at different Jewish Federation breakfasts maybe 10-plus years ago. I don't think you really knew anyone. I know, Paul, you said you grew up in Mexico, or you're just Mexican by family?
No. So I grew up in Mexico, but I moved to San Diego for high school.
Okay, and then Artem, when did you move? You said you're Russian, I didn't know.
2009, I moved to LA, but I came from Russia when I was almost 10.
Okay, and so, you know, when you go to these charity events or any real estate networking event, I would imagine, you know, two outsiders, not from LA, not even from the country, you know, seeing guys who act like they've known each other their whole lives, and especially myself growing up here and going to school here and having a built-in network, it's, you know, I have a leg up just because of the connections that I have developed over my entire life. And then you guys come in and without knowing anyone have really integrated yourself into the community and into the industry, and to be as successful as you guys are, I mean, it's really a testament to your hard work, your no bullshit attitude. And I guess my question is, like, how did it feel those early days of trying to just crack into a pretty insular community?
I think both of them, like, immigrant mentality, or just like keep learning, keep growing, keep pushing, figure it out.
And I honestly, I didn't feel like I was even trying to crack in. I was just trying to make money and do deals. I couldn't even care about the community. Me and Paul hung out. We have our jiu-jitsu friends, and we're like we just kind of met people going along doing deals. We were just trying to do deals.
I love it. You know what, that's the best attitude. And I know you guys are very active now, whether it's charity through the Federation or YPO, or and Artem when he's, you know, on his couch in his boxer shorts just tweeting and getting 100,000 followers. And maybe you're going to advertise, I don't know, something about yourself, Artem, and you're the Kim Kardashian of real estate Twitter.
I don't know what happened the last 3 months. We didn't have many deals to fundraise. We didn't have many projects going on, and I just wanted to share some thoughts.
Has anyone compared you to Kim Kardashian before?
Never.
Well, there you go. That was reason enough to do the podcast. Guys, I mean it. I really, truly am impressed with what you guys have built, and continued success and the growth of your company, Schoen Tepler, not Tepler Schoen. That flip of a coin just changed the course of your guys' history. And thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you, Andrew. And honestly, feelings mutual, Andrew. I remember when you started, when you partnered up with your partner and started. So the growth on your company has been impressive.
It has been awesome.
Well, thank you. Well, thanks again. And I know we'll be talking soon.
All right. Take care.
All right. Bye, guys.
You've been listening to Real Talk, Real Estate Discussions with Andrew Kirsch. You can catch prior episodes at skalarkirsch.com and on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. Thank you for your positive reviews, comments, and for sharing the show with others.